Add to John's welcome and say how good it is to have a room full of people this evening for Sean and Yang Shi's baptisms, a special occasion, and I hope the one that you will find helpful, whether you're a regular here, and I hope that this will be an encouragement to you as you can celebrate with our friends. And if you're here as friend, family, whether you come to church normally or not, then I hope that you will find yourself welcome here and that this will be of help to you. We're here to consider the baptism of Sean and Yang Shi. We're going to look at a bit of the Bible now just to consider some of that in its context. And as we come to that, let me try and give you something of an analogy to understand something about Sean and Yang Shi and why they're here doing what they're doing this evening. This is an image I find helpful just to think about the Christian faith. I'd like you to picture our friends at the airport, and there's a plane. It's a poor picture of who Jesus is, but kind of run with the illustration with me for a minute, if you would. I wonder how you think of Sean and Yang Shi and their faith. How would you think of that? Are they perhaps plane spotters? People who go to the airport because they're interested in planes, because they have an interest in the plane, in Jesus. Is that what we're to think of their faith like? Perhaps we might say, well, that's a good thing. We might say, well, that's lovely, but you know what? I'm more into trains than planes. That's more my kind of thing. Maybe we think of them as people who are interested in a particular kind of faith. Maybe, on the other hand, we think of them as people who are inspired. They're inspired by Jesus, isn't it? And isn't that encouraging that somebody's found some inspiration in life? The kind of people who can go to the airport and watch plane after plane taking off and say, I believe I can fly as well. We might say, well, that's cute that you found some inspiration from Jesus, but I find inspiration from sport or from some other source in life. Let me suggest that neither of those are really what's going on with these two. I've got to know them a little bit in recent weeks. That's not their story. They're more the kind of people who go to an airport so they can get on a plane and go somewhere. Their faith isn't so much a matter of being interested in Jesus or even being inspired by him, but it's of getting onto the plane, of being inside the plane. Getting in on Jesus' life. That's what they're about. And so that wherever this plane Jesus goes, so too they can go. I'll drop the image now, but I hope you get the idea of what we're talking about. And when we think of the journey of Jesus, then we're going to think, as we'll see this evening, that the story of Jesus is one of death and of resurrection. That he goes through to gather people from all over the world to know him. And that baptism is a vivid, tangible, wet picture of what it means to be in on Jesus, to participate in the drama of Jesus' life, that just as he died and was raised, so too the same happens to these two. To consider that, we're going to look at one of the New Testament documents. This is Mark's fast-paced biography of Jesus. If you've got one of the church Bibles in front of you, it's on page 1023. Do turn to that so you can see where I'm getting the things I'm going to say this evening from, page 1023. If you're a regular here, we've been looking through the final chapters of Mark's biography in recent weeks. If you've not been here in recent weeks, you'll catch up very quickly here. Mark has been writing his account of the life of Jesus. It's a short, punchy, dramatic account. And in chapter 15, which will be the pages open in front for you, you see the events of Jesus' death on Good Friday 2,000 years ago. The day is unfolded, and where we join the story is at verse 40, towards the end of that. That will be on the right-hand page if you're using one of the church Bibles. Now it's Friday evening, as we're told in verse 42. It's the evening of that Friday. I'm going to read for us, and then we'll consider just a few of the things that are going on here. So this is what Mark writes. Some women, verse 40, were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. It was preparation day. That's the day before the Sabbath. So as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he'd already died. Summoning the centurion, he asked him if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. So Joseph bought some linen cloth, took the body, wrapped it in the linen, and placed it in a tomb cut out of rock. Then he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb. And they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him? But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out, fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Do keep that open in front of you as we consider it for the next 20 minutes or so. You'll notice as you've got that on page 1024, there's a little note saying the earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses don't have the rest of those verses that are listed there. Let me just make a couple of comments on that before we go to look at the section I've read. This is an inconsistency, it's acknowledged. There are a small number of minor variations in the biblical manuscripts that we have, loads of manuscripts and a few inconsistencies between them. They're always acknowledged, just like here. It's worth also saying that there's no Christian teaching that gets altered by the presence of these extra verses in Mark's gospel. There's nothing after verse 8 here that conflicts with any of the other accounts of the resurrection of Jesus. But what we do know is that the weight of the manuscripts we've got suggests that Mark ends his account there in verse 8. And that's why we're ending there this evening. In literary terms, you noticed it's rather abrupt, isn't it? The women run off stage. And you can see why somebody might have felt the need to round it off. But the sudden ending is deliberate, and we'll see why as we listen in to this account. It'll engage us, I think, just as it has for Sean and Yongxi. Well, as we look at this evening, three claims for us to consider. The first claim is this. I'm going to come up on screen if this works. There we go. The first claim is that Jesus did die. He was buried. Look with me at verse 40 down to 47, the section in chapter 15. Jesus did die. He was buried. Did you notice in the video the consistencies between the stories of our friends? That somewhere along the way, they say, someone read the Bible with me. Yongxi's aunt as she's growing up, Sean's friend in his first year at university. Here's a young man and a young woman who have checked out the evidence for Jesus. And here, as we look at the evidence for the death and burial of Jesus, it's important that we notice this is a matter attested not by scientific experiment, but by evidence, by historical records. And I wonder if just for a moment you do what our friends have done and have a look at it with me. Consider the various witnesses of the death and burial of Jesus here. Firstly, there's this guy, Joseph of Arimathea. So you can see him mentioned there in verse 43. He's a prominent member of the council. He's a respected political, religious leader. He's a man you'd know who he was. And he's the man who handles the body of Jesus. He asks for the body, he gets given the body, and he places it in a tomb by verse 46. He's someone you could go and check. So did he do it? Is this the account of Joseph? Is that what happened? That's the first witness that Mark documents for us. Then he calls on the centurion. Do you see that one? Here's the centurion, verse 44, the one who stood officiating over the death of Jesus in the previous section of Mark's account. He's the one who stood there in front of Jesus as he died, we're told in verse 39. As we come to the centurion's evidence, Pilate's surprised. It's Friday evening. He didn't expect that Jesus would be dead just yet. Crucifixion is a long way, a very slow way of killing people. And Jesus has died relatively quickly. So Pilate calls on the centurion. Could you confirm for us, did it happen? Is he dead? In verse 39, the centurion who saw how Jesus died then testifies in verse 45. Pilate learns from the centurion that it was so, that Jesus was dead. It's not that Jesus somehow is going to have survived this incident. The professional Roman executor says he was dead. And then there's the third set of witnesses, the women. Their testimony isn't the kind of thing you'd make up. They wouldn't legally have had a right to testify in a court in the first century. You only document it because it's what happened. And there were women there in verse 40 who watched from a distance as Jesus died. And now again in verse 47, the same women, they saw where he was laid. And at that point in the drama of Mark's Gospels, the last time you see Jesus, he goes off stage as a corpse laid in a tomb. What do you do with the trail of evidence? It tells us this. It tells us Jesus died and was buried. And this evening you're going to get a picture of that. That in baptism, in that water over there, we bury Sean and Yongxi underwater. We say their old life, their life without Jesus, their life against Jesus. You heard Sean's testimony of he mocked God. And they say in that water, I'm burying that old life. It's over. This evening in some ways is a celebration, but it's also a funeral. It's a funeral for old Sean and old Yongxi. It's to say that life is over with much relief. Throwing off an old way of living to say, here's a new way of life that I've already begun that I now want to continue in. That in baptism, these two are claiming Jesus' historical death as part of their present and part of their future. And in baptism, he claims them for himself as well. Here's the first claim this evening. Jesus did die and he was buried. But there's a second claim for us to consider here, that Jesus is risen. That he wasn't in the tomb. Look with me at verses 1 to 6 of chapter 16, if you will. Let's acknowledge here, shall we, that to claim that Jesus rose from the dead is something extraordinary. But please note, what we're seeing here is not naivety, it's not hype. This account is from 2,000 years ago, but people knew then what they know now, that dead is dead. Mark, previously in this account, reports that Jesus had predicted that his resurrection was going to happen time and time again, but it seems that though they shouldn't have been surprised, those around him didn't really get it. They weren't persuaded, because dead is dead. They were not gullible. They were not whipped up into some sort of frenzy by their grief. Now, the women we meet here in verse 16, in chapter 16 again, they are on their way to anoint the corpse, to put perfume on it, because it's dead. Because it smells. They were not expecting him to be alive. And as we consider our friends this evening, we're not to consider people who have been unduly swayed by peer pressure or by the crowd. I think there are roughly 200 people in this room, maybe slightly more, but the maths gets complicated if we go past that. There are about 200 people in this room. If this room represented Malaysia, then Yongxi would be one of only 8 out of the 200 of us who would have her evangelical faith. 8. She's not being swayed by the crowd. If we take Sean and make this a room that represents Britain, well, then he would be one of 16 out of 200 confessing the faith that he is confessing this evening. These two are going against the flow of their own cultures. They're not just being swept along with this. Well, what happens here in chapter 16? Notice the first thing, that these are the same women. These are the same women who saw Jesus die in verse 40 of chapter 15. By the last verse of chapter 15, they're the women who saw where he was laid. And now it's Sunday morning. It's Sunday morning. They get together on the third day after Jesus has died. First day, Thursday evening through to Friday evening, a second day from Friday evening to Saturday evening, and now a third day starting on Saturday evening, running into Sunday. And they gather together on this first day of the week, on Sunday morning. And it's just after sunrise. It's early, but it's light. They can see what's going on. They're not stumbling around in the dark. There's enough to see. And on the way, they're expecting a corpse. That's why they've got up that morning, to anoint the body. Do you notice what it occurs to them in verse 3? On the way, oh no! When Joseph put the body in the tomb, he put a massive stone in the way to seal the tomb. How are we going to get to the body? They are not expecting to find what they find. They arrive to a surprise in verse 4. The stone's been rolled away. I wonder what goes through their mind at that moment. Shock, fear, nervousness. And yet somehow, I don't know if I would have done this if I was there in verse 5, they enter the tomb. They go in and they see what's going on. Can you imagine being there? And what do they see as they enter the tomb? They saw a young man, verse 5, dressed in a white robe, sitting on the right side. And they, Mark says, they were alarmed. They were alarmed. I mean, wouldn't you be? This is not what you came out that morning to see. You were expecting to see the cold corpse of Jesus. And here is a young man sat in a white robe in the tomb. Mark makes clear to us this young man isn't Jesus. This is an angel. This is a messenger from God. And he tells them, don't be alarmed. It's a very appropriate response given their emotions in that situation. Don't be alarmed. You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. These women who have seen the place where Jesus has been laid, now they see that place and it is empty. He's not there anymore. There's an empty tomb. And here is this angel claiming that Jesus is risen. The first claim, Jesus is dead and buried, now a claim that he's alive. And that helps us to understand the other side of what's going on in baptism. That in baptism, our friends are burying their old life, but we're going to lift them out of the water after we put them into it. It's good news for you both, isn't it? They're going to be raised out of the water because they're beginning a new life with Jesus. A life in which they are still going to stumble and struggle and sin. Sean will still struggle with his identity. He will still pity himself. Young Chi will still get anxious and still struggle with confidence around other people. But they'll do it with a deep hope, a confidence that one day they will be with Jesus forever in this world renewed, that they've begun a new life and that old life is being put behind them. And that day after day when they're tempted to give up, when they're tempted to think, oh, I've just blown it so bad, they'll be able to say to themselves, but I've been baptized. God has claimed me, this sinner, for himself. He's mine and I'm his. The death and resurrection of Jesus sets a pattern for what's happening with them this evening. And if these two claims aren't true, if Jesus didn't die and didn't rise, well, they're just having a bath this evening. So I wonder, what do you think? What do you think's going on this evening? Are they having the most public bath of their lives, or is something more significant happening here? Claim one, Jesus did die, he was buried. Claim two, Jesus is risen, he was not in the tomb. Claim three, Jesus can be known. Two more verses for us to consider here, in verse 7 and verse 8 of chapter 16. Hear the words that this messenger says to them. Tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee, and there you will see him just as he told you. We'll take a couple of moments just to consider what's going on here. This messenger says, tell his disciples and Peter. In the drama of Mark's gospel, you need to know that Jesus' disciples fled when he was arrested. They left the stage of Mark's drama in chapter 14 on Thursday night. They've not been seen since. But these women are told that Jesus isn't done with his friends yet, that he wants to see them, that he's gone ahead of them to meet with them. And not just his disciples, but Peter as well. These are precious words. And Peter. Peter who, after they'd all fled, stuck around for a little bit longer and then denied Jesus three times. Gets singled out by name. Peter who has royally messed up. And the message is Jesus wants to see him as well. Do you hear what Sean said? He'd set himself up against God. He didn't want anything to do with the Christian faith. But Jesus met with him. So just a couple of years ago, a friend invited him to read the Bible in his first year at university. And Jesus walked off the pages into Sean's life. Because his friend Jemima invited him to do that. if you're a regular here, I wonder if I could encourage you. It's a really easy thing. I don't want to demean what happened because it's a courageous and a bold thing, but it's not a difficult thing either, is it? Who could you say that to? Would you just have a look at the Bible with me? Would you have a look at who Jesus is with me? It'd be a really simple, straightforward thing to do, wouldn't it? To invite somebody else to consider the evidence for themselves, to give them the opportunity to be met by Jesus. And this messenger says, Jesus has gone out of his tomb alive to meet with his friends. He's gone actually to the place that Jesus first met them, back in chapter 1 of Mark's Gospel. He's gone to start the story all over again for them. But these disciples and Peter, they've blown it. Mark quotes from the Old Testament and says they've been scattered in judgment. They've found their story come to an end. But then Jesus has been struck down for them so that he might regather them as his own people through his death and his resurrection. I think it's a precious thing for him to do for them. And it tells them something significant. It tells them that everything they've got with Jesus isn't earned. They don't have any kudos for being the early adopters of the Christian faith, the people who got there before everybody else. No, it's all sheer love and pure gift. They blew it. But he wants to walk with them. And that's the story of all Christians, isn't it? It's the story of the church, a community of failures and betrayers and rebels and adulterers and murderers and broken people who've messed up. That's who you find if you come to church. People who say, it's all gone wrong. I was wrong. But Jesus wants to meet with me. And the messenger says, tell his disciples and Peter. What does he say? Tell them, you will see him just as he told you. I wonder what you think of the Christian hope. In part, it's about avoiding judgment, but it's not just that. In part, it can be considered to be a hope for heaven, but it's not just that. This messenger's words capture the essence of it. It's about seeing him. It's about Jesus. On what basis? On the basis that he told you he would do this, just as he told you. And that's our friend's story, isn't it? They met Jesus by reading the Bible. They heard his voice through its pages. He walked off the page into their lives and they want to know him. It's been asked by many people, would you be happy in heaven if Jesus wasn't there? And the Christian says, no. I wouldn't be happy in heaven if Jesus wasn't there because it's all about him. I'm in it for Jesus. And how can you be sure of that? How can that anyone have confidence in that? Well, not a blind confidence, not a delusion. No, the hope that the Christian has of Jesus, of being with him, is based on the words of the most reliable, most trustworthy, good person that human beings have ever seen on the face of this planet. It's based on Jesus being trustworthy. It's just as he said. Well, Peter and the disciples are told that they will get to see Jesus, just as they've been told they would. Well, did you notice, lastly, how that was received in verse 8? Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Quite frankly, wouldn't you be? Isn't this not the Sunday morning you were expecting to have? And Mark leaves us on that note. Why would he end so abruptly? Why would that be the end of the story? I think he does it for this reason. He does it to engage us. He does it to ask us, well, what about you? See Mark and his account enacted on a stage, and as the curtain falls, this messenger, this young man, is the only one on stage. Everybody else has gone. The disciples have fled in chapter 14. Jesus' body has been put in this tomb, but it's not there anymore. The women who were there, they've run away as well. And now the messenger's words are left hanging in the morning breeze of that Sunday morning 2,000 years ago. You'll see him just as he told you. Let me suggest those words still hang in the air for us this evening. Would you go where you could find him? Would you go where you can find him? Can you entertain the possibility that Jesus can be known today? Will you go even in the 21st century to the pages of the Bible and consider the evidence of Jesus, to consider him and what he's saying? Whether you'd call yourself a follower of Jesus or not. And to be honest, as a follower of Jesus, reading the Bible doesn't always feel like the easiest thing in the world to do. But if I can know Jesus more, well, there's motivation to go and read it, isn't it? And perhaps you say, I don't know Jesus. Well, let me encourage you. Would you read these pages? Would you take an opportunity to hear what's said? That's why we get together here on a Sunday. It's not because we're trying to fuel some kind of delusion. It's not because we want to escape reality, but it's because we want to engage with the evidence and grow a relationship with Jesus. The Oxford scholar C.S. Lewis describes two ways of knowing things. His image to help us understand this is of standing in a tool shed where there's a crack in the roof, and you can see a beam of sunlight coming in through the crack in the roof. And he says you can know much by looking at that, by studying that beam, standing away from it and seeing what's going on. That's one kind of knowing. You can stand at a distance. But he says there's a whole other kind of knowing which happens when you step inside the beam and look along the beam. That kind of knowing's altogether different. It's the difference between peering in through the window of a family home at Christmas from outside and being sat by the warm fire, opening presents and experiencing the joy of family life. It's a completely different kind of knowing. See, in the end, interest in Jesus is good. Inspiration by Jesus is good. But the Christian faith only really works when you get inside it. And that's what Sean and Young-Shi have done. They've stepped inside. And in baptism, they enter tangibly into the drama of God, into the very life and death and resurrection of Jesus. And in doing that, they're a message to us that says we can do that too if we want to. What do we do with this? If you're a follower of Jesus, can I suggest observe what's going on this evening? If you've not been baptized, maybe that would be a thing for you to do. I'd love to discuss that with you. If you know Jesus, would you get to know him more? Would you invite other people to get to know him as well? Could you do that? And if you wouldn't say you follow Jesus, I wonder, would you consider him? Myself or John, or members of the welcome team who've got badges on, would love to help you find a way to do that and in a way that would be appropriate for you. We can get in on what our friends have found. It's not just for them. It's for the rest of us as well. Well, in the next few minutes, we're going to do three things, and I'd love you to join with us in this. Firstly, we're going to pray for our friends. We're going to take this belief that Jesus is alive and put it into action. We're going to do what Young-Shi said she did growing up. She knew that her prayers got answered. So we're going to pray for them. We're going to ask them some questions. We're going to say, do you believe this stuff? And they get to tell us in front of all of us. And then we're going to take them down into the water and immerse them under the water and bring them back up into the